This is the Creative Sports Podcast. My name is Justin Peterson, and joining me are Garrett Wright and Brock Rom.
My current wife used to live in Plymouth when we were dating.
Got it.
I
nice.
Say current wife as if I have an ex-wife.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Ryan Thielen of Triglass joins us this week to talk about cinematic content. We dive into preparation, process, gear, and the business of relationship building. Ryan is big on creativity and betting on yourself, which is how he earned trust to create differentiated content.
Everybody ready?
Yep.
We're going to do it at 38. It's like a waterfall claps. I feel pressure to say something after the clap, because otherwise the intro doesn't really work unless somebody says something after the clap. So I always, if nobody says anything, I feel a lot of pressure to say something.
I'm just going to stay silent from now on then.
Hey everyone, welcome to the show. My name is Garrett Wright. I want to start out with a big thank you to APM Music for donating the tracks we use on this podcast. Also, a reminder that this podcast is an extension of the sports creative community on Slack. So if you're hearing this and not a member of that community yet, you should head over to sportscreativeslack.com and sign up for free.
Today we have Ryan Thielen joining us from Triglass. And a big reason why we wanted to talk to Ryan was a big part of, you know, what he posts on Slack and the amount of love that the work gets in the Showcase Inspiration channel. But the focus of today is really the cinematic content that gets talked about. And so I just wanted to have you start, Ryan, if you could define what cinematic means to you and how you go about creating content.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually a really good question, because I think it kind of means different things to different people. I mean, things look cinematic, right? What does that mean? I mean, it looks like a movie, sure. I think we try to take it a step further at Triglass. We're definitely pushing to legitimately have a story involved in each video. And it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, there's this big narrative arc or anything like that. But we're trying to tell the story of the team, the culture, something that makes the audience connect with the piece. It's not just this soulless, you know, kind of hype video. So to me, I guess that's what cinematic means. And we're not really trying to make it look like anything. We're just kind of doing what we do and doing what we love. And you see the results of that.
All right, so let's get into your background a little bit and help us understand where you started from and how you really got interested in creating content. And I know you started Triglass when you were still in college, but can you take us back even before that? Where did your interest start?
Oh man, well, my dad bought me one of those little Mac Minis, you know, ages ago, and that was kind of the beginning of this whole thing, right? So I started editing a bunch of our hype videos for my football teams, baseball teams, whatever. Really fell in love with editing. But I didn't really know I wanted to be a filmmaker. Didn't know I wanted to go into video until actually the movie The Aviator came out. It's a Martin Scorsese movie with Leonardo DiCaprio. He plays Howard Hughes. And that was kind of the turning point for me. I went to that movie, and it was like that first experience for me in a theater where you just kind of fall into it and you forget where you are, and you know, everything goes dark and you're just in a completely different universe. So it was that magical feeling that just kind of stuck with me. And I kind of went and dove right into all of Scorsese's work after that. And it just led down this rabbit hole of all sorts of great, great movies and films. And I just got kind of obsessed with it. And I realized that there's, you know, as silly as it sounds now, but as a kid, I didn't know that movies really, you know, there was intention behind camera angles, behind an edit, behind story, and how that's physically, emotionally affecting you. I didn't really understand that until that moment. So that was kind of a turning point for me as a, you know, as a young, aspiring filmmaker. And I still have that movie ticket today, actually. Kind of fun fact.
Well, no, I was just about to say, you know, starting your own company, that has to be, you know, an intimidating thing. So, I mean, beyond just like, you know, how did you get into the creative side? How did you get into running your own company?
Yeah, a whole nother story. So, my dad was an entrepreneur. He started several businesses. So I definitely had that kind of background growing up. I was around a lot of it. But to be honest, you know, kind of coming out of college, I had finished a lot of my classes early. I had most what I needed done by the time I was a senior. I was applying for jobs. I was trying to find opportunities, and I was trying to find something that really aligned with what I wanted to do in my life. And I wanted to do more than just be kind of an editor or just kind of do the grunt work, right? I wanted to do something special, unique, something that was my own. I think we all do. And to be perfectly honest, I just couldn't get a job anywhere. I couldn't find anything, or at least anything that was interesting to me. And it was kind of one of those moments where it's like, this is my best option, even though it's, you know, there's nothing behind it. There's no guarantee. So I just kind of spent my final year in college preparing for that transition, my vision of what the company would be. I actually hired one of my good friends right out of college. I had a small amount of money I had saved to start the business, and pretty much had put all that money into his salary for the first 3 months. So it was either we make it or we don't pretty early on, which is pretty crazy. And that's kind of how it all started. And just funny enough, one of our first clients was the Minnesota Vikings. It was kind of an interesting relationship and kind of an interesting position, because they were looking for more of an employee, I think, and they were looking for somebody to kind of step in and do some of the grunt work. It was kind of funny because it was both things that I was looking for and not looking for coming out of college. Yes, I was looking for an opportunity like this. I would have jumped at that immediately. But at the same time, you know, they were looking for someone to kind of just name clips, organize footage, do all that kind of stuff. But I took it as an opportunity to, you know, kind of get my foot in the door to come in and maybe show them what I can do. And it led to a lot of interesting things down the road that kind of pushed us into the sports industry. And that's one thing I should mention. I didn't go into this intending to be a sports video production company. In fact, in many ways, I still consider us to not, that's not our primary thing. It's something that we do really well, and it's something that we want to continue to grow off of and grow in, but it's never been the primary goal of the company. I think it was that kind of unique look, that kind of, that different perspective that I brought, that we brought to the industry that kind of made us appealing, you know? So that's kind of how it all started.
When I think of Triglass, I think of extremely high concept pieces, right? Whether it's an intro video or those player personnel pieces, those personal player pieces. When you're going in and you're concepting a piece and you're creating a storyboard, you talked about intentional camera angles for emotion and audience effect earlier. How much is going into your pre-production planning on your concept and your storyboard versus maybe some improvisation on shoot day, you know, or later in post in the edit?
Yeah, that's a great question. So a lot of our process lives in pre-pro. We do a lot of storyboarding. We've done animatics. I mean, we've done it all, right? I mean, we've done it to the point where we've basically made the video before we've made the video. So it kind of depends on each project. You know, if some videos are more textural and a little bit less linear, then there's less storyboarding going on. And there's a couple things that I think we do really well that kind of helps us get to where we want to go. And there is no templated way to do this. I think that's the important thing here is I don't have a process where it's like, well, you have to do this and then you have to do that and then you get the amazing product. And that's not how we work. It's certainly not the most efficient way. And I think a lot of other people in our industry are more efficient than we are, but that's just not who we are. That's not how we work because every project is unique. And even the creative process is unique. So sometimes there are projects where discovery is necessary for that end product. So we will go into it, into pre-pro saying, we need to discover this. We need to find a way to get something different to help tell this particular emotion, this story, which might lead to additional shoots, test shoots, experimenting. I mean, I think if you're too rigid in your pre-pro, then you're just copying. You're just copying your inspiration. You're copying what your client wants. You're copying others. And that's why we see a lot of that going on in our industry. We see a lot of copycat stuff. So it's important to understand that every project is going to be a little bit different. There's good best practices. But at TriGlass, it's really dependent on what we're doing, which I don't know if that's a really satisfying answer for you. But
That's a good answer. And I'm going to dive a little bit deeper into project. I'm a big, one of my hobbies, I used to do it a little bit more for my job, is director of photography type work. And I think you guys have fantastic visual direction on a lot of your shoots when it comes to lighting, framing, and camera movement. I especially like the way you guys use light painting to help convey emotion or highlight a subject in a scene. When you're going into a shoot, translating that storyboard to a final image, how much of that trial and error, how much time do you take to get that scene lit, to get all the set pieces in place and get it ready for when talent is on set and you're executing as close to your storyboard as possible?
That's a great question and a huge challenge in our industry, as you know. When media day comes rolling around, it's game time, right? Like you better be ready for the 60 seconds, 30 seconds. I've had as little as 6 seconds, believe it or not, with players. This is something that we fundamentally try to do a little bit differently. Obviously, we all understand the challenges of media day, but this is why we're trying to get outside the box a little bit. You know, so a lot of our content might be shot with doubles. It might be shot outside of the studio. It might be shot outside of media day. So we can have the time to properly light and do a little bit extra. Coming back to media day, I mean, you're talking about having a lot of trust in your guys. I mean, we have core people here that we trust, that we work with, that really, truly understand lighting. And I'll be honest, I don't think there's many people out there that really understand lighting. I'm not one of those people. And when you find somebody who really gets it and really understands it, came up as a gaffer, you know, usually is how it works. Those are special people. Those are really, really special people worth their weight in gold. And we have a few of those guys that can do that. And we work with them a lot before these really hectic media days. And we know exactly what they need to be successful. We make sure we have the right team in place. And it's been literally a process of years of developing chemistry and just getting on the same page, not only with ourselves, but with our clients on how to make that work on such a tight schedule. And I should note that a lot of the guys we work with, which I think is a little bit different than some of our competitors or just in-house production teams, a lot of the guys that we work with on the production side come from the film industry. They come with a filmmaking background. And it's all about lighting in that industry. You know, it's a lot of it is lighting, cinematography, composition, a very thoughtful process. And that's what we want. That's what we're going for. We don't want to have to kind of resort to having to do similar lighting setups with different colors for different teams. That's one thing that really I just don't believe in fundamentally. It would be easier. It would be cheaper. I just don't believe in it. I hope that answers your question, but that's kind of the process of how we attack this thing.
Yeah, creativity by itself is extremely inefficient, if you want to look at it that way.
It is.
So when you were with the Vikings, you mentioned that they wanted you to essentially be a logger and help them in that. So how are you able to, I think one of the first pieces that I saw was the motorcycle piece that really put you guys on the map in my mind. For first time I saw it, and it was different, right? You talk about differentiating yourself. Can you talk a little bit about how you leveraged your opportunity as a logger into creating a concept and content that stood out with the Vikings?
Yes. And I have to give a huge shout out to the Vikings, Brian Harper, Skip Krueger, all those guys. I mean, they literally changed my life, right? I mean, that opportunity is, you look back at your career, I think all of us have that moment where, you know, if it goes a different way, you'd be in a completely different spot. So that opportunity alone was a game changer for us. And it's given me a lot of the opportunities that we have. So what happened was I had randomly called the Vikings, just kind of a Hail Mary. I had seen that they were hiring an editor, and I had called Skip, and he's like, "Oh, you're the first person that called." And I'm like, "That's weird. How many people have applied?" And he said something like, I don't know, 1,200 people, yeah, something like that. And I'm like, "Well, you know, that sounds intense." And we had a good conversation. He told me, he said, "You should apply for this job." And I said, "I'm not going to do that," which I think surprised him a little bit. But I said, "There are 1,200 people or whatever, 1,000 people applying for this. I think you're just going to lose my resume. But here, why don't you check out our website? Why don't you take my information down? If you guys need anything, give me a call. I would love to work with you. I'll do anything you want." So 3 months later, he gives me a call and he's like, "I want you and I have two other people in the industry that we're going to interview, and we're going to give one of you guys this position." And so I go and I interview, and I was the only one that had like very little experience. Basically, I didn't have a reel. I mean, I'm fresh out of college, and I have no idea why he picked me. I've told him this. I said, "I don't know why. I wouldn't have picked me." But he did, you know. And so I come in, and as you said, I was a logger. I was doing the grunt work. I was kind of supposed to stay in my lane, and maybe reflecting back on it, maybe I didn't all the time. but I was young and hungry and aggressive, and they kind of threw me this project. And it was a Pro Bowl project. Every year they do an edit for their best players, right? To kind of promote them. But it was really at the time a throwaway project. It was just kind of do a quick edit and get it out, you know, day-to-day stuff. And I said, "Well, what if we, you know, what if instead of the highlights, what if we do something more cinematic? What if we like kind of tell their story of who they are and why they're great more through other means that are more of a metaphor?" And they said, "Well, I don't know about that, you know, whatever." And some of the guys were on board with it, some of them weren't. And it just kind of fizzled away, as most things do. And so I kind of took a risk at the time, and I walked into the locker room, which you're not really supposed to do. And I grabbed Everson Griffin at the time, who was our Pro Bowl defensive end. And I said, "You're going to come into studio tomorrow and we're going to film this thing, and it's going to be a Pro Bowl video." And he's like, "Okay." And so the next day he came into studio. I filmed it. We did it. And that was the first one we did. Back in 2014. And so then the Vikes were like, "Okay, this is cool. Like, the fans really like this. Do another one." So we did another one. We did one for Harrison Smith. Then we did one for Xavier Rhodes. And progressively, they kept getting better, right? And by the time we got to Xavier, the fans kind of like blew up about it. They loved it. It was exciting. It was something completely new. And that was the beginning of these Pro Bowl projects. And every single year since, which, you know, obviously that was the only year I was internal with the Vikes. But every single year since, it got crazier and crazier and more cinematic. And the idea of it was, I just wanted to tell the story of why these people are so special. I mean, they're already in the 1%, right? They've made it to the NFL. Now they're in the 1% of the 1%. There is something about these people that makes them tick a different way. And to show it through highlights, you're only showing that as the final result. But what? How'd they get there? What is it? And 9 times out of 10, it's something about their personality. It's something mental. And that's what I try to represent in those videos. So they're all, every video is a metaphor for who they are, where they came from. The one that you saw, ironically, is probably the last one. That one was Eric Kendricks. And he was on a we had him on a motorcycle. He loves cars. He loves vehicles. But to make it even better, you know, he's just such a great tackler. He's always where he's supposed to be. He just runs everybody down really well. Made a lot of sense to have this video where he's literally chasing after another motorcycle and pursuing that opponent. So that's what we did. And it's kind of like an action movie motorcycle chase scene, but it's all representative of who he is as a person and who he is as a player. And so we could go through every single one if we wanted to, but they all kind of relate to the player in that way. And so it was those videos that was the bridge to what we're doing right now. You know, once teams saw that, they go, oh, these guys can do opens, they can do intros, they can do graphics packages, all the capability is there. And then also there's something different about this. They're not in a light box. They're not in a tube world. You know, there's something about this that is connecting me with this person. And so now our job is to bring that into opens and intros and all the other videos that teams need. There can be depth to these videos. They can have a soul. They can extend past a year. Fans can go back and watch this. It can be a representation of that year. It doesn't have to be a throwaway piece. And so we talk about the process being inefficient and being creative. And that's fine because that's the cost of what it takes to do something at that level. So every single Pro Bowl video I've ever done, I've lost money on it. Every single one. And that's because I really care about these projects. They're a part of my career. They're a part of who I am. Kind of circling back to starting the business, I didn't start this thing for it to be a business. I'm not here to be a business owner. I'm here to be a director. I'm here to be a creative. We're not here to just make sports videos. We're here to tell stories. It's just kind of what we do.
I think it's fascinating hearing that mindset from you because it's the investment and willingness to invest your own time and energy and money really into a end product that stands out and is differentiated. And I think a lot of times when we get into creating content, we talk about, well, you have to show people what you're capable of doing for them to want to hire you and be willing to hire you to do a job. And you took an opportunity that you had with the Vikings and kind of push your way into that to open that door to create a better opportunity for yourself and really, you know, grow from there. So I guess I'm just trying to figure out if with the young listeners that are listening here, what direction or what can you say to help them realize their own potential?
I think it's different for every single person. It was different for me. It's different for you guys. And it's a really hard thing to talk about because I would love to help these people. I have people reach out. They email me. They call me all the time. And by the way, if you want to talk, you know, shoot me an email. We can talk. I love it. Part of the reason I totally will take any call regarding that topic is because when I tried to do it, coming out of college, nobody talked to me. Literally nobody talked to me. I think what is really important is to realize why this is special to you, why you want to be here, why are you here? What do you want to do? What gets you excited? What makes you passionate? And pursue it, you know, pursue it, trust your vision, trust your abilities, and work hard. I mean, this isn't going to happen overnight. You're going to have to pick a lane, find a skill set, and get really good at it. When I was in college, I asked my dad, I said, am I making a big mistake? Am I going into an industry where I'm going to be like serving popcorn in a movie theater someday? You know, I mean, ironically, it's what I saw a lot of my peers doing after we graduated. And I get it because it's so tough to get a job out there. And my dad probably gave me the best advice he ever gave me, which was, if you are one of the best at what you do, no matter what it is, you will have a job. And so that's the mentality that you need to have, is you need to find a way to work your way to the top and to be the best. You're probably not going to get there. I'm not there. I'm nowhere close. But I think it's that pursuit that is important. It's the act of trying and grinding and working to get to there that I think helps you get to that next level. So it's not a really satisfying answer because most of the answers I'll probably give are, well, it's different for everybody. It's different, you know, and it is. This is an industry that doesn't have a path, a clear-cut path. I mean, you look at the film industry, you know, in the beginning, you know, when they got started, there was a path. You know, you literally worked your way up the ladder from being a PA to whatever, to a DP, to a director. It doesn't exist anymore. So you got to go out there and you got to make it happen.
You mentioned your time in college. So let's get into more about like the deliverables. And, you know, we've talked a little bit about the Seahawks video intro that you guys have created and the Buccaneers intro that you've created and shared in the Slack channel. Can you talk us through where you learned, you know, from your time in school as a film, cinema, video studies major at St. Cloud State University? What did you learn in school that was transferable, and how did you, you know, what skills have you developed since then that has led you to where you are now?
Well, first of all, St. Cloud, I loved it. I had a great time. Very flawed system in that at the time that I was there, they didn't really know how to handle production. We had probably the most incredible film theory classes of all time. And that has been incredibly valuable to me. I enjoyed it. It opened my mind to all sorts of possibilities. It was great. Our production side of things was very weak, and they couldn't answer questions like, you know, why does this video have a, you know, why is it cropped on the top and the bottom? Like, why is it, how do I get my video to look that way? Why is everything I shoot 16:9, but these movies are this way? And they just couldn't answer those questions, you know, which are pretty basic questions. And so what it kind of forced me to do was, first of all, I got a job in the department as kind of like a lab manager, equipment manager person. So I had access to all the gear, which it wasn't a ton of gear, but it was enough. I encouraged them to buy a Blackmagic camera. So when that 4.6K Blackmagic came out, you know, we bought that camera. And so it forced me to go out, and I didn't have anybody pushing me to make anything. I just had to make it myself. So I did two short films in school. I had to set it up. It wasn't for any project. It was just the passion of it, just the pure, you know, interest. And maybe that's a valuable lesson that stuck with me. Maybe it was just the, if you want something, if you want to learn how to do something, you just got to go and do it. No one's going to tell you how to do it. And that's kind of true in this industry too. Like, if you want to figure out how to do something, you know, there's not really a class out there. There are some classes out there that will help you, but you need to kind of just go out and start making stuff. You know, you need to find what you want to do and start doing it. So maybe that's something that I learned. And of course, coming back to the film theory stuff, I loved it. I had a great time with it. So from a directing standpoint and just understanding the history of cinema, where it came from, how it developed over the years from, you know, very early cinema into the film brats, into the, you know, the directors we have now, and just kind of how that progression happened, how editing changed over the years. All of that, very valuable.
You mentioned gear there, so we're going to talk a little bit of gear. When you guys go on a shoot, are you renting cameras, lenses based on the client and the look you're going for? Are you guys renting grip trucks on set? Do you own a certain amount of gear? You know, you talked about 60x9 versus, you know, anamorphic. How much are you shooting in anamorphic when it calls for it? Just give us a little general background there on the gear you guys are using.
Yeah, sure. So we own a Red Epic W. When that camera came out, we were really early on that list and we had to wait forever to get it, but we got it. first project I shot was a Pro Bowl video with it, of course. So we have that. We have a lot of the camera support, right? You know, I don't believe in owning a lot of gear because every project needs its own thing. So we own the camera. We always get a grip truck. We always usually, you know, get this stuff locally, right? Because it's more affordable and makes more sense. So all the lighting, all the, you know, even the lenses are usually local. It's kind of, I think a few of my guys kind of poke fun at me and kind of roll their eyes at me because these lenses we rent are expensive. And they're just like, Ryan, like, just why, you know?
It's like, important. You need the cooks. You need the Angiunu. You need it.
I mean, I got to do it. I can't not, you know, it's like, oh, this would be great if we use the cooks or the cow is here or whatever. Yeah. I got it. I just can't. I got to do it. So that's important to us. You know, we choose based on the project and sometimes the specs of the boards. You know, when you have a client like the Seahawks, you can't win. You know, they have one board that is like basically an anamorphic board. And then they have one that's the exact opposite going straight up. So what do you do there? I mean, we ended up just shooting anamorphic and then tilting the camera, you know, yep, to shoot portrait mode on a Red, as ridiculous as that sounds.
Quick aside, when I was my first year at Notre Dame, me and another producer, Zach Dudka, who used to be at the Rams, is now with Notre Dame, we got in touch with Cook and they were going to let us borrow a full set of anamorphic primes, their anamorphic primes. But our board was 16x9. We had no reason to shoot anamorphic, but we just really, really, really wanted to shoot on the lenses. So we're like, well, we'll just shoot in the highest resolution we possibly can and frame for 16x9, but we're still shooting anamorphic because we're not passing up using these lenses.
For those that aren't lucky enough to be in that category with all of that, Ryan, can you just talk through why you go with those lenses and what the difference is between anamorphic lens and a lens that you would use for a 16x9 shoot?
Well, you know, a lot of the very cinematic lenses we use are full frame 16x9, you know. For example, one of my favorite lenses is the K35s, famously used in Aliens, as well as a bunch of other movies. And we have some of those in town here in Minneapolis, actually. So we try to use those. They're always gone. You know, someone's using them or some film or TV show has them or whatever. But so, I mean, the aspect ratio, whether you go anamorphic or not, is obviously something that's very important. Anamorphic comes with all sorts of issues. I can't help it. I love it. My post guys hate it, but so it kind of starts there, right? I mean, if a client has a board that it just really lends itself well for anamorphic, I prefer to go that route. But to kind of come back to, I think what you're getting at is more of the attainable glass. Well, here's the deal. Most of our content we shoot on our in-house glass, which is I bought years ago. I bought these Zeiss lenses that were fairly affordable. They were basically designed for photography, and then I've had them modified for cinema. But, you know, they were like $500, $700, $1,000. I kind of bought them one at a time over the years. And those are kind of my go-to, like, hey, if the budget isn't there or whatever, I use these lenses. But there's a lot of great glass out there that's obtainable. I mean, you look at the Sigma Art Series lenses, and guess what? Those are pretty. They're really, really pretty. And we've used them. We've had shoots, you know, good budgeted shoots where we're like, we need to use the art lenses. I mean, they're sharp, they're crisp, they have like this very cosmetic look. So I think it just comes down to what you're looking for, and don't get too hung up on the glass. I mean, we kind of geek out about it, but at the end of the day, the creative wins, you know, the execution wins. So you can have the best glass, the best camera, the best whatever, but if the creative sucks, you're toast.
Right. So. And I think knowing the characteristics of your lens and what you want out of it. You talked about those Zeiss lenses, and one of the biggest criticisms of all Zeiss lenses, I know you didn't have CP1s or CP2s, but the big criticism of CP1s and CP2s is they're almost sterile sharp, right? Like it's not cinematic that it's sharp, right? But you can promise that, you know, you can make something look cinematic if with really whatever gear you have, if you understand how your gear is behaving, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you might go out with a Zeiss lens, which in my opinion is great for, you know, that commercial look, that very mm-hmm. like crisp, clean, tack focus sharpness. But if you want something a little bit more cinematic for a couple bucks, you can put a ProMist filter on it or a cheap ProMist, you know, knockoff filter, and it's going to behave a little bit differently. So I think mm-hmm. you're exactly right in saying that, you know, making the gear work for you and having the story, prevail is important, but also knowing your gear and knowing how you can manipulate it is important too to help get that effect.
That's a good point. Yeah, it's a good point. And creativity all the way from pre-production into production post, it's required in the whole process. So we've done some weird things to get the results that we need under budget. And that's one thing I will say. If we're talking to young filmmakers right now, oh, I don't have the budget. I didn't either. You know, none of us did in the beginning. And what matters is taking what you have and making it look 10 times better, you know, so then you can get that next level project. So like if you have $1,000, make it look like a $10,000 video. So then you can start getting $10,000 videos. So then when you get $10,000 videos, make it look like 20, then, you know, keep going and keep moving up the ladder. But here's the deal. It never ends. It never ends in the sense that you always have to find a way to make the budget work there. It's not like you get to some threshold and you're like, oh, we're good. Like we can just do whatever we want. No, you're always going to want more. You're always going to have challenges. The bigger the budget, the more pieces there are, the more crew. This is a part of the filmmaking process. This is part of it. So you have to realize that if you want to be here, being skillful at using your tools and finding ways to be creative and get better results than what you have is important.
And then I kind of want to get into the business side a little bit of what you do. You know, I think a lot of the people on the Slack channel probably tend to be a little more on the full-time side or, you know, working within an organization. But for you, starting a business is a unique challenge. And we talked about it a little bit earlier, but client development, you know, how do you go about finding clients? How do you go about developing those relationships and, you know, just keeping the lights on?
Well, that's a really good question. And I'm sure our competitors are listening in very closely right now. it's tough. It's really difficult. And one thing I will say to, you know, the guys that are working in-house, one thing that I envy about you is that you get to focus on the work every day. I have to figure out a way how to be better than most of the people that I'm competing against. I have to find a way to, you know, make sure that I'm paying all my guys every month that are salaried. I have to keep the lights on, and it's a tremendous responsibility. So one of the hardest things about my job is that I need to be both. I need to be this high-end, super, you know, involved creative, because it's what I love to do, and I'm a part of the fabric of what makes up TriGlass. And then also, I got to find a way to be equally successful on the business side. So that kind of pulls me both ways. I think it's also something that's a little bit different about TriGlass. I don't know a lot of other companies. Actually, I know a few, but not in our industry, that are like this, where they're working that intimately on the creative side, literally editing, shooting, directing, whatever. But on the business side, it's really tough. And then you get hit with the coronavirus. We're the first people that are probably going to get cut on projects, right? Before they start laying people off and all that stuff. So I just kind of have the philosophy of, if I keep doing good work, I keep improving, and I keep our guys here satisfied and keep exploring what they want to do, make sure that their goals in life and their career are satisfied, that we're going to have success. And so that's kind of the primary thing that I take into account when I'm running my business. And it's difficult, because I have to balance being responsible with also wanting to make these projects as great as possible. So like it's kind of a dangerous zone for me to be in, because like I absolutely will be like, this is a cool project, I just needs like a little bit more money maybe, you know. It's tough, but I really enjoy it.
And then once you have the client, you kind of get into the project, you know, working with the client, you know, how do you talk through your vision for a project? How much do they come to you with a vision that you then need to work within? Like what does that relationship look like, you know, once you've signed the contract?
Yeah. So, it's different for every client, which I'm sure you guys are sick of hearing, but I really like having a very back and forth intimate relationship with the client, and hearing their voice is important. One thing I learned inside the Vikings, just listening to them, hearing about other projects, I think there's probably nothing worse than having a different group of, like a different company fly in, do a project, fly out, and they're done. And, you know, they kind of do what they do really well, and you kind of get what you get, but they're not really listening to you. And I don't really believe in that. And also the in-house guys, they know their fans, they know their organization 1,000 times, 100 times better than we do. So I really want to make sure that if I take on a project, there's collaboration, they're excited about it, which they always are. And we can have a back and forth, because that's how we're going to get to the best spot. There's 0% chance I'll be able to tell you exactly what the best result is going to be here. And I think if that's the way you're going about the project, I think you're just kind of getting a cookie cutter thing, you know. So I'll use the Seahawks as an example. I think we have such a fantastic relationship with the Seahawks and their in-house team, and we support them year round. We're constantly working with them on just day-to-day projects, and we'll just throw them work. And it's valuable to us because we kind of continue to learn more and more about them and about their team, their fans. And that intimacy is really important. It shows up in the videos. I think every year we do another Seahawks video, it gets more nuanced, gets more detailed. And this year was a great example of it. I mean, there were fan theories online that were pretty interesting to read, that they were hitting on some things and kind of coming up with their own thing, which is great. And that only comes from us really understanding and really having that relationship with the client. So, I mean, that's not unusual for us. Most of our clients that we've had repeat business from, that's our relationship.
To build off the business questions here, you've started to do an Inside TriGlass series that focuses on sharing a little bit of insight into your process, what you did and how you were able to execute, because quite a bit of your work does include some level of VFX or taking a scene that is that you shoot and then amplifying or magnifying it to advance the story. I'm just curious what went into that thought process of starting that series and, you know, just sharing your insight into how your process works.
Yeah. well, I think in our industry, it's funny because I almost feel like we care more about the behind the scenes than we do about the final product at times. So, we wanted to share some of that with you guys. We wanted to share it with everybody in our industry, in our world, put my face behind it. A lot of people don't really know who I am. And I've been told by people that I need to be in front of the camera a little bit more. I need to be out there and talking and doing exactly what we're doing right now. Because I think our philosophy is very attractive to people and it makes sense when we can talk about it. I'm not great in front of the camera. I kind of resisted it, but my guys kind of forced me to do it. And I think it's good. I'll get better at it over time. But we wanted to do it because, why not show what's possible? You know, why not show that we're doing things a little bit differently and how, just kind of how our brain works, how our thought process works, what makes us special. I mean, it only seems like a beneficial thing for us. And, yeah, I think it's fun. I think it's cool. And we want to continue to do that. You know, we want to continue to share how every single project we do has a lot of love and care and time and effort put into it. And that's what you're going to see every single time we post one of those videos. You're not going to see repeat stuff in them. So that's important to us.
I just wanted to welcome you to the club because I know Garrett, Brock, and I have all talked about this. It's tough sitting back and editing the podcast and having to listen to yourself back and judge yourself and go, wow, I did a poor job of asking that question, as I've done multiple times in this recording already. But you do start to get over it at some point, though.
It's brutal, man. It's brutal. I'm not a fan of it yet, but I'll get used to it.
I was kind of going to jump in with the same point where it's just, that is not a fun process when you're used to being behind the camera and you know, that's what you think you signed up for. And then all of a sudden you're having to be out in front. And I mean, even to your point, just some of the business duties where maybe you'd rather be just out creating. And there's a lot of stuff in this industry that you kind of have to do that you don't want to do. And especially when you're in a situation like you, where you own your own business and you got to promote yourself as well. That's a crazy position. I know I don't think I'm made out for that freelance world. I think there are people that are, and I don't think I am, and I'm glad there are, because there are a ton of advantages of going out freelance and going and doing that yourself and being your own boss. And I think it's really cool that you just have that initiative. I love it.
Thank you. Yeah. It's been a lot of work. I'm very happy it worked out this way. I feel very fortunate. You know, starting your own business or even being a freelancer, I feel like it's a low percent chance success sort of situation. And it's not necessarily that, you know, we're overly special. It's kind of a combination of hard work, talent, and luck. And so that's kind of where this all comes from, I think. And, yeah, I mean, I do kind of want to touch on that a little bit, you know, with people, maybe some people here are considering starting their own business or whatever. I'll tell you one thing. If you value entrepreneurship, if you value, business, administrative work, all that kind of stuff, taxes, if that sounds like something you can do, great. This might be a good route for you. If you want to focus on the creative though, find a place that can really help you get there. That's a good place for you to be creatively, that values you as a person, that values your goals. Because if there's one thing I envy, it would be just focusing on my work every day. Because I don't have as much time there as I would like to have. And, I think I'm kind of learning there's this fallacy where the more people I hire, the more I'll be able to delegate, the more time I'll have. And it's just like, I don't think that's true either. So everything's just a give and take 100%, you know, I wouldn't change anything. I love the freedom I have. I love the ability to say, you know what, I'm going to make this project, whether it has this budget or not this budget. I'm going to have a little extra time to do. Maybe we made a little extra money. We can go do some creative, you know, films or short projects or whatever. Those are all things we pursue. But yeah, it might be a little too easy to just look at the Instagram account and say, well, they're perfect, or they have this and that, whatever. I think that's an unhealthy way to look at it. So, yeah, I'm kind of rambling now, but it's a lot of fun what we do. And, I think we're one of the rare, one of the few teams that kind of back up our filmmaking and storytelling with actual projects on the side that we do. And kind of outside of the sports industry work that we actually do. And it just kind of goes to show how passionate we are about it. And it's not all about the business. It's definitely more about the passion and the storytelling, the filmmaking.
Can we end on one insight from you that makes Content Cinematic that you felt like you learned and that really helped push you along, or you had the moment? I know you talked at the very beginning about seeing that the Aviator Scorsese movie that really pushed you into this kind of work and interest, and you've kind of talked all along here about your DIY mentality and making things happen for yourself. And I'm just wondering if there's a little carrot or nugget that you can leave for people who have an interest in this that that you learned early on that you felt helped you.
Yeah, I mean, I think it, if we're talking about what helped me kind of get to that next level, it was the curiosity. The curiosity of why does this look this way? Or why does this particular video or film have this effect on me? Staying curious, honestly, is probably the most important thing that we do here at TriGlass. We're always looking at content. We're always talking about it. We're watching movies. We're trying to find out ways to kind of explore different parts of filmmaking, different areas that we haven't done before. And it's that curiosity that I think drives you to discover new things. I think a really dangerous thing to do is to be a copycatter. And I see it a lot. You start copying things. Well, that looked good. I'll just make it like that. I think that's a really bad, toxic way to do things. And what you're robbing yourself of is you're robbing yourself of individual thought, of creative thought. You need to work that muscle in your brain, the creative part that is understanding why something is working and how can we improve on it, or how can we do something entirely different. That's probably the most important thing. The rest will come. You know, I think when I was in college, I was obsessed with how can I make my stuff look cinematic? What lens do I need? What camera do I need? It's the wrong approach, because that stuff will all come. The gear will come, cameras will come, the lenses will come. What's so much more important is the creative, the process, how you're attacking, what story you're trying to tell, what emotion you're trying to bring to the piece. Much of this can be done through editing, by the way. Editing is such a huge part of storytelling. I mean, when editing was invented, which sounds ridiculous, but when it was invented, it was a game changer. Because before editing, we didn't even have storytelling. It was an image. It was a photo. It was a moving photo. You know, they'd take a shot of like a train or something, and they thought, well, this is cool, you know. But then somebody figured out that if you take, you know, image X, image Y, put them together, you get something entirely different. And even rearranging those same clips give you different emotions, different stories. The power of editing is so powerful that it basically is the foundation of storytelling. you know, basically. And you can do that for free, right? You can do that for free. So we mentioned this in the beginning of the podcast. I started out as an editor. I still edit on almost all of our projects, all of our big projects for sure. Editing is a great way to kind of work that muscle, I think. And then just stay curious, keep dreaming, I guess.
We'd love to hear your thoughts, feedback, and suggestions. So pop on over to the Sports Creative Community on Slack and connect with us and your fellow creatives there. The quickest way to get us to stop this podcast is to not tell anyone about it. So leave us your 5-star rating and don't forget to subscribe so you're the first person to catch each new episode. And remember, the world needs your voice, so keep creating.